It sparked.
It sparked, okay.
Yeah, that's not good.
House Committee on Revenue for June 4th, 2015 will come to order. I will note, colleagues, that we're moving over the work session on House Bill 2077 to Monday. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2968. Dave, do you want to introduce that for us? And then we'll hear from the good representatives.
Yes, sir. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. House Bill 2968 is about poverty reporting. And we have -A5 by Rep. Wisman and Gallegos. They're here to explain the amendment.
Great. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Barnhart, Honorable Committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Mr. Chair, thank you. This committee heard this bill on April 29, 2015. And it is a bipartisan bill sponsored by my colleague on my left and Representative Sherry Springer and Senator Mark Hass in addition. Mr. Chair and committee members, the bill you heard, we went back and tried to work on the report. So we have an Amendment 5 that we're asking you to approve and move this bill. We've worked with a lot of people on the -5. As you know, Mr. Chair and committee members, this is sort of a companion bill to the bill that Representative Gallegos led, and we passed on the floor this week 60-0. I don't have to remind the committee that Oregon, just been reported, has the lowest high school graduation rate in the nation. And we as legislators are sent here to try to solve problems. I believe that our high EL student population, high number of students in poverty, impact this graduation rate and also our poor absentee and dropout rates. I believe that Representative Gallegos and I both agree the school district's use of additional state allocations from the state school fund for students in poverty needs the same transparency and accountability as House Bill 3499. We tried, as I said, several drafts. We think this reporting in the -5 is the easiest. Please accept the -5 into the bill and pass this bill so we can improve our rates. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and committee. For the record, my name is Joe Gallegos. I am the state representative for House District 30, and I'm joining the good representative Wisnett here to encourage the committee to accept the -5 amendment and pass House Bill 2968. This bill will establish school district report on use of about $250 million additional funding for students in poverty families per the budget. These students need assistance to succeed, and this additional funding will provide the state school fund for that purpose. We want to be sure that the outcome-based practices that are being used, like after-school programs, summer programs, events, parent training, and so on, other best practice models will be used. This bill, like House Bill 3499, can help these students and improve our graduation rates. And so, again, we do hope you can support us in this, and it is part of a larger package that will help us to really reach our 40-40-20 goals eventually.
Mr. Chair, may I add, too? Didn't read my complete script. I should have stuck on script. But one of the things in here that is different than 3499 is we're saying the State Board of Education will develop the rules for this bill. And I assure you and everyone that I will work with the State Board of Education to be sure that they include in developing those rules the stakeholders and also school district people, so there's input on what's being reported. But as Representative Gallegos listed to you, we put in here what we're looking for. These are pretty general things. They're not each dollar that we're looking for, how the school districts. We want to know that you're making some effort to expend that money to help these special children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for being here. You guys are getting to be quite the duo. So what's the hope for outcome regarding, what's the status quo right now minus the bill? Fast forward 2 years, what would you hope that we, the legislature, and I guess the general education community in Oregon would know then that they don't know now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. We hope that we're not the lowest graduation rate. It's going to take a while. And, you know, I think that some school districts are probably using this money effectively, but we don't have a system of looking at that. And I think as legislators representing the citizens of Oregon, that we need to have some sort of report that we can work with and say, be sure. I think as I testified in this committee when we first brought the bill before you, that I think one of the important things is for these children to succeed, stay in school, is that we have good health care. I've looked at the option of it only costs us $50 million that we could take out of that $270 million to hire a school nurse for every elementary school in Oregon. You have to be healthy to learn. And the children in from poverty families, we need to have that. So, Representative Johnson, I think we want to see that these children are succeeding. I understand the difficulty in identifying that if you hear testimony today about that. But I have been assured the fact that leaders in each school district do know who these children are, and they are making decisions. We heard that in testimony in the higher ed, innovation, and workforce. The good representative from Reed could tell you, confirm that they are people in the school district that know who these children are, and they do use that information to plan activities. That was given to us as a quote by an ex-principal in Eugene.
Very good.
I would just add, Representative Johnson, that, yeah, in a couple of years, what I would anticipate is really finally having some good data, and data that we as legislators could use in making good policy. I mean, I think that's what we're really after. That's sort of, to me, the end run that we're after.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony.
And we hope the chair will have a work session to move it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two additional panels who want to be heard today. Hmm. Iris Maria Chavez. And is there, now I have another panel that signed up, but is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Okay, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. Representative Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Iris Maria Chavez. I'm the Government Affairs Director with Stand for Children Oregon. I wanted to come and speak to you about this bill. This is something that we've worked with the Representative Wisnitz's office on and Representative Gallegos over the last couple of months. As they both mentioned previously, we have for a number of years been asking districts to let us know in the ELL programs and services what percentage, how much of the money that they receive for that additional weight are going to programs and services. That information has been really pivotal in helping us as an advocacy organization and our parent members, as well as I hope you policymakers, in identifying places where we'd like to do further research into promising practices and also where trouble areas may lie. We feel that this bill begins that process for those students who are receiving the poverty weight as well. We think it's an important area for us to start to get better, more useful data and information to identify where we need to be putting our resources from an advocacy perspective and where you all can be making some decisions about better policy to serve students who are living in poverty. So we just wanted to reach out and let you know that we as Stand for Children Oregon support this effort and look forward to working with you further on it.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Chuck Bennett, Lori Wimmer, Morgan Allen, please.
Good afternoon, committee members, Mr. Chair. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the 42,000 members of the Oregon Education Association here to thank those who brought this bill and also the Dash 5 amendments for their laser focus on the issue of poverty in education. We agree wholeheartedly that the conversation needs to happen. We know that adults and children receiving welfare TANF in Oregon numbered last year over 108,000, that children receiving food stamps were about 42% of our students, or 282,000, that EITC recipients exceeded 285,000, and that households receiving federal rental assistance were over 55,000. We are among, by percentage, one of the states with the highest degree of poverty, and from that you can see we have a lot of other educational indicators related to student academic success that are also matched up with those poverty figures. So when 42% of our students come to the schoolhouse door experiencing hungers, our members know how this will affect their ability to learn and to thrive. We know that five-year-olds from poor households come to school with an average vocabulary that is one-sixth that of their more affluent peers. We know that, according to the educational research, that the summer slide phenomenon in poor households results in about two-thirds of the achievement gap that can be accounted for because of that phenomenon. Clearly, poverty and its attendant barriers to academic success are front and center in our members' minds. And we know that someday when poverty ends, students at all income levels will have their educational and career dreams realized. But until then, we have to make sure that our conversations around poverty and students in poverty in our educational system have to be addressed in a way that's clear, inclusive, and bottom line, helpful to the students that we are serving. House Bill 2968, as introduced, appears to have started from a premise that we disagree with, that the one quarter extra weight that's ascribed to poverty in the state school fund distribution formula is somehow a money follows the child line item, or an earmarked fund, if you will. But that's not what the formula is about. As I'm sure most of you know, or all of you know, it was in 1991 that the House Revenue Committee created what we use as the distribution formula on the heels of the passage of Ballot Measure 5 and then the subsequent Deschutes County Circuit Court decision that told the state that they needed to make sure that now that they were the primary funders of public schools in Oregon, that the funds, however large or small, needed to be distributed in a fairness through a fairness lens rather than the way we had done it previously. And so that distribution formula does not earmark things. What it does is it accounts for uncontrollable cost factors using a mathematical device, and that's what the weights are, no more, no less. They aren't this amount of money pays for this service. They are a way of trying to get our arms around district needs that might differ from one district to another based on their census, who those kids are that they are serving, because not all kids cost the same amount to educate well. So that's what the formula does, and the bill, by demanding expenditure accountability on the notion that this extra weight is a poverty dollar that ought to buy an increment of outcome, is therefore based on what we perceive to be a misunderstanding of that basic premise behind the formula to begin with. So in an effort to refine the proposal, we know that a lot of folks worked behind the scenes on a set of amendments that we just received this week. That's the A5 amendments that I believe you have in your possession. And it retains the concept of a poverty report, but veers somewhat from the increment level accountability piece. But still, it is misunderstanding from our perspective how and whether school districts can track these students based on their socioeconomic status. When the poverty weights are calculated by the department, they are based on a federal census document which you all authorized 2 years ago in a bill that the department brought before you. That is not a headcount of how many kids are enrolled in each school district who are in poverty. What it is a formula with a lot of assumptions about how many kids living in attendance area might be enrolled in that district. That's how we distribute those poverty dollars. So when we talk about students availing themselves of, and this is language from the amendment, events, training, medical services, after-school programs, summer programs, and other programs and services available to assist students who are in poverty families, we can't identify which students those are in a district individually in order to be able to track that dollar with that kid and that program. So it's not doable as written. Even the free lunch numbers, which we often use as a poverty proxy when we talk about ways to get kids into services and programs, are based on a voluntary form that some students and their families choose not to submit because of a fear of being stigmatized. This is a very sensitive issue. So though the A5 amendments are very well-intentioned, and we are very appreciative of that, we believe that this is just one of several problems which they suffer. I won't go into those details now, because what I'm really asking for from you all is a consideration of another amendment before this bill moves that would establish an interim work group that includes all the stakeholders who understand the formula and also understand the educational implications of poverty on our students, and that is able to contemplate ways to be helpful to these students at moving forward in a way that does not disrupt their privacy and educational needs. So we would love to participate in that work group, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. And as was mentioned earlier this week, the House passed really a historic piece of legislation that was comprehensive and will do some great work to improve the educational outcomes for our ELL students. But what many of you didn't see was the six-plus month process that probably involved 50 to 75 people and experts and educators and stakeholders and parents and people that represent ELL students coming together, throwing out issues, trying to work through things. And that's where sort of we're having trouble with House Bill 2968. It's a great first attempt. It's an attempt to try to make some of the similar improvements that the ELL legislation made for our students in poverty. And as you know, the numbers in Oregon are pretty staggering. You know, more than one in five of our students in our K-12 system live in poverty. That's more than 100,000 kids. More than half of our kids qualify for free and reduced lunch, 285,000 kids. And I think one of the most alarming things we see in our schools is, and this is urban, rural, big and small, we're seeing higher levels of concentrated, persistent generational poverty in some of our schools, despite our relatively robust economy. So we understand that there's a need. One of the other things I would mention, too, is there was an interim task force on the state school fund chaired by Senator Devlin and Representative Comp. And actually, one of the things in that task force report, they had some national experts come in and look at our formula. And one of the few faults, if not the only fault, that the national experts saw in our formula is they believe our formula underfund school districts for poverty. That is, the quarter weight that our districts get for poverty is insufficient to meet the needs of those students in poverty. So that's something we need to look at as well. I just want to mention two issues we have with the A5 amendments. Again, these are well-intentioned. We support the idea of doing this work, but we have some big concerns about we don't track these students. You can't go into a classroom or a school the way you can with English language learners or special education students. We know who has IEPs. We know who our ELL students are. We do not know specifically which students come from families that live in poverty. That's just information we don't have and, frankly, we're not allowed to have, and that's not how the formula makes those distributions. Our second concern with the bill is the bill delegates the responsibility to the State Board of Education to decide what are the outcomes metrics we want to measure for our students in poverty. We have some big concerns with that. I think over the last 4 years, you've seen some issues with OEIB and some of the other state-level boards where some of the things they've recommended have been at odds with what the legislature desires. So we have great concerns with turning that totally over to the state board to make those decisions. So with that in mind, I would echo my colleague from OEA. We would encourage you to adopt an amendment that would create a work group similar to the ELL work group. Let's bring all the stakeholders, educators, and experts together and make a comprehensive plan, bring that back in February, and pass it. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I would just concur with the comments that have been made by my colleagues regarding these issues, not go any further into them. I just want to mention again, it took us the past 6 to 8 months to achieve the ELL bill that we think is an outstanding piece of legislation that you have already passed. This issue becomes even more complicated in a number of ways, particularly because of the lack of data on specific students allowed under the law. So we think there's quite a bit of work to do here. We are more than willing to become involved in it. We were very involved in convening the ELL work groups during the interim. We found that to be an extraordinarily successful model for dealing with these kinds of issues related to the formula and the expectations of both stakeholders and policymakers around the formula and how it's being how money is being spent in school districts. We are more than willing to, again, serve as either a convener or actively involved and bring as many experts as are needed to the table. COSA has made a substantial investment as an organization in professional development for the administrators in the state around dealing with poverty-related issues and have developed national relationships that can bring some real expertise to the table on this issue to assist us, and would fully expect that by your February short session or the next regular session to be able to come to you with some recommendations where we think there are some policy possibilities like those I think contemplated by the sponsors of the bill to accomplish the kinds of goals we believe they're talking about. We know a lot of this information. You're not a committee, a policy committee that we come to usually with the kinds of issues associated with this. We'd be glad to go back into lengthier hearings on the kinds of things that are happening in your schools around poverty-related issues. But certainly we can return to you with the portions of the bill related to the financial issues in the districts and also develop policy-related bills as needed to try to accomplish, we think, the goals that are set forth by the sponsors of the legislation. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? We had a study group set up for last time, Representative Comp's bill, that basically said they were unable to gather the data they needed in order to make recommendations about school funding formula because of the need for a quite a bit more extensive information gathering. Are you proposing that we're going to be able to do that in some way? I heard suggestions in that direction, and it occurs to me that when the committee is looking at formula changes or at a specificity around how funds ought to be spent, the detailed data on actual costs and best practices is essential to be able to get there. And of course the earlier group, the name of which I'm forgetting, told us that they couldn't do it because they didn't have the resources to do it. Mm-hmm. So given the very clumsy question, can you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to take a stab at it. Again, Lori Wimmer for the record. The school funding task force is, I believe, the interim group that you were referring to. And with limited resources, I thought they did one of the best jobs I've ever seen a task force and an interim do. And they did make substantial progress on a lot of indicators. But because this stuff is very sensitive and the data, to drill down and do a good job of the research in a way that has fidelity to accuracy of data relative to Oregon, you really do need to have some dedicated resources to the enterprise. And without that makes it tough. You kind of get what you pay for when there are no resources to do that. We do know, though, on a national level what the indicators say about children in poverty and what the barriers are that they present when they come to the schoolhouse door. And we also know what educational researchers who are in the school finance realm say about the poverty formula. Mr. Allen just mentioned to you that we are all aware of research that suggests that Oregon's distribution formula is is held up in the nation as one of the best as far as calculating a good way to divvy up the dollars you do allocate on as fair basis as possible, with the exception of poverty perhaps being too low. I think they recommend that it goes to a 50%. So we have some secondary source resources that we could rely on and look at it for that piece of this question that is about distribution formula. And I think we could all get to a place where we would be willing to potentially test those waters. But again, the level of scrutiny to which some of those issues would need to rise with respect to research, really good research, is based on the level of investment the legislature is able to make.
Are you proposing that we consider a dash six that we don't have yet? Or are you proposing that this work group be set up in some other way? Or what's the plan?
Mr. Chair, we would be – I think there's a commitment from the organizations that were part of the ELL work group, whether it's ad hoc, informal, or legislatively convened, or you ask the chief education officer or somebody like that to convene the group. It doesn't matter to us. We're committed to do the work. So we would be happy to do it any way the committee would –
Would you propose the amendment you'd like us to consider?
Sure.
All right. Sure. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the bill calls for the State Board of Education to engage in rulemaking. And the part that's of greatest interest is lines 15 and 17, where it says the progress of the school district in meeting the objectives and needs of students who are in poverty. Are you suggesting that a work group would establish those objectives and needs? Is that what we're hearing you say the amendment would suggest? Mm-hmm. And if, because it looks like this bill would get us there because you'd have the rulemaking, mm-hmm. What is it that the work group would do that the rulemaking wouldn't?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that could be part of what the work group does, absolutely. I think our biggest concern is that the ELL process and why it was so successful is because it was a bottom-up process. It brought in educators, people that work in the field, advocates, stakeholders, community-based organizations, and we threw out tons of different proposals. And what we're seeing here, this is top-down. This is just giving the State Board of Education the authority to do that. Now, it's possible that they could involve some stakeholders at some level, but it doesn't guarantee that. So that's our concern, is that frankly, we think the people in the school districts and the experts on this would do a better job than the State Board, to put it bluntly.
Well, as usual, Representative Benz, you ask the key question. Other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would add just one more, if I might.
Please.
Some of those terms are kind of loaded terms to my way of thinking, and they're undefined in the amendment. And so one of the first things I would ask is, what is progress? What are the objectives? What are the needs? Those are the three words in that sentence that was just read depending on how they're defined, have concerns about what it is that we're really striving for. I think of an education as being much broader than a test score, for example, as a progress indicator. We know that when we are too laser focused on just test scores, what we end up with, and we have some research we've just done locally on this, there are some areas of the state that are so focused on that third grade reading test score that they are canceling recess for 5, 6, and 7-year-olds in some high poverty areas in order to double down on kill and drill, which is not the same thing as reading. It's learning how to decode very successfully to pass the third grade test. That would be a problematic response to an expectation of progress. So we'd have to be much clearer about what we mean by progress.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson,
thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up that might help as a clarifying question, but Morgan and or whomever, we did pass the bill off the floor regarding ELL reporting. Could you delineate the difference, let's say, between those resources that are waiting via for ELL categorization versus poverty, and perhaps some of the nuances in determining the differences in how those funds are allocated?
Right. I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think that really gets to the core of one of our concerns with how we roll this out. Again, we're supportive of the concept, but I'll use the example in ELL. Again, we know who those students are. They're identified. We know which students they are in our schools and classrooms. And our district budget managers, they're already coding within the state budget coding system where districts report expenditures that are related to ELL services. So there's already a system set up to do that. The bill will improve that, bring stakeholders together, and sort of bring a laser focus to that. The biggest challenge is, I'll just take one example that's in the bill. It talks about expenditures on summer school programs. So we don't know who the kids in the summer school programs are in poverty. We could assume that certainly some of them are. But summer school programs benefit all students. They benefit credit deficient students. They benefit students in poverty. So how do we delineate the money? Let's say a district spends $1 million on a summer school program. How do you delineate the sort of increment of that expenditure that benefited the kids in poverty in the summer school program and report that there's an improved outcome from that increment of money. I think that's the challenge we need to sort of figure out how to do. We don't have a system set up to do that right now. We have that basic system for ELL, but that's the biggest challenge, is how do you say these specific dollars improved these specific outcomes for these specific kids, which we cannot identify. We know generally who they are from the free and reduced lunch. Representative Witness is absolutely correct about that. We know generally which schools are poorer or richer, for lack of a better term, but we don't know the specific students.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and all the testimony on this bill that we've heard today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2968 and open a work session on House Bill 3125. Kyle? This is property tax break. Have a sunset already built in?
Yes.
What's the date? You give that to us.
Yeah, I can. Go ahead. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3125, we do have the -8 amendment. It is up there in OLIS. And so what the House Bill 3125 with the -8 amendment, it's would make changes to an existing property tax exemption related to food processing equipment. So the existing exemption is a five-year exemption for new property that's placed in a service by a food processor, but it has to be new property of the food processor, not necessarily new. It could be used property but newly placed in a service. But the exemption is for the first 5 years after it's placed in a service. And under existing law, the food processors that can qualify are related to fruit, vegetables, nuts, legumes, and seafood processing. The -8 amendment would include the processing related to grains into the definitions that are already established for the exemption. And it would also exclude a person engaged in the business of producing any product that contains marijuana or marijuana extract from qualifying for the exemption. It also would modify the definition of qualified machinery and equipment to include, or excuse me, the definition languages are also included with grains. So it is working within the same framework. Some of the earlier amendments were making changes to the definitional language, where this would just be inserting grains into that existing language. The -8 also requires qualified machinery and equipment used to process grains to have a real market value of at least $100,000 when placed into service in order to qualify for the exemption. It would allow the State Department of Agriculture to fix, assess, and collect or cause to be collected fees on food processors at an amount necessary to cover the cost of certification. So the first point is Department of Agriculture certifies this equipment that it is eligible to receive the exemption, so there are some costs associated there. It does require the State Department of Agriculture to also submit a report on the impact of expanding the exemption to include grain processing, and that report would have to be submitted to the Interim Legislative Committee's Revenue Committees not later than September 15th, 2018. And the changes would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. So that would be this upcoming tax year. We are already at this time past the initial exemption application. So for grain processors who want to qualify for this upcoming tax year, they would have to pay a late fee of $200 or 0.1% of the value of the property in order to qualify. We do have the paperwork on the -8. The fiscal is, you just received a hard copy of the corrected fiscal. The one that we have up in OLIS, the amounts are still the same, so the expected amount cost for the Department of Agriculture, those aren't changed with what's on OLIS. It was just some of the language was including some of the older previous amendments. So we'll get that change on OLIS, but the hard copy you have in front of you does have the updated figures. And then on the revenue impacts side, and one thing I should note is, as this is just including new language within the structure of the existing exemption, it would fall under the same sunset date of, double check this, the existing sunset date for the food processors is June 30th, or I'm sorry, that's the wrong one, June 30, 2020. And that was updated, it looks like, back in just a couple years ago in 2013, House Bill 2735 extended that. So there is an existing sunset that would apply to the grain processing as well.
And that doesn't change in this bill?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It still falls in within, yes.
Okay.
That sunset still exists. So the revenue impact, as you'll see, it does step up in initial biennium, so you see it increase from about 300,000 to 800 and then 900,000, and that's reflective of the exemption is for 5 years. So in the very first year, you see about a revenue loss of 100,000 or so. In year two, it'd be about 200,000, and that's reflective of year one equipment and then any new equipment that comes on in year two. So in the outer years, the 2019-21, that's about where we'd expect the revenue impact to hit at its high water mark and then maybe grow a little bit over time reflective of the industry. But it'd be about $1 million once it's been in place for about 5 years, and you begin to see property placed back on the roll that has been receiving the exemption for the previous 5 years. And I should note that there is, looking at the historical figures for the existing exemption, there's definitely some fluctuation there. So some years can be larger than others, reflective of grain processor, or in this case, what would be a grain processor buying a large piece of equipment. So there could be some variation there, but this gives a middle point of what to expect.
Okay, thank you. Does this fiscal suggest that a required referral to the Committee on Ways and Means or not? I'm getting a head shake no from Dr. Warner. Good, that's useful. All right, Representative Benz?
Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3125.
Thank you, Representative Benz. Moves the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3125. Discussion? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I just was wondering, so I understand, would canola oil be considered a grain? It's a brassica seed, but is it considered a grain?
Very good question.
Because canola oil can be used for both biofuels and for food, and so I was wondering in that particular case.
That's not a question that came up in the hearing or in any of the conversations I've had, so I can't answer it. Representative Gleininger.
Thank you. So I noticed that there is an exclusion for businesses that produce products that contain marijuana or marijuana extract. I'm wondering if that applies to hemp and hemp extracts also, or if it just singles out marijuana businesses that use grains and also involve marijuana.
Another good question.
Representative, it does, the language in the bill is specific to marijuana or any product that contains marijuana or the extract, so I guess we could check with the Department of Agriculture to make it crystal clear on whether that would include the hemp. It was part of this language was inserted when there was discussion of the bakeries as well.
I have a follow-on question.
Remember, just to sort of add to that, remember that the original law covers raw or fresh fruit, vegetables, nuts, legumes, or seafood. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the issue in adding that language about marijuana was to make certain it was clear that that issue is being dealt with by a different committee on a different bill. I think that was the concern.
Uh-huh. Well, I would note, and I'm going to be a courtesy yes on this, but I would note that, you know, if we've made a decision as a voting public that we're legalizing marijuana, and we certainly understand that there's going to be a fairly significant business in edible marijuana products, many of which are baked goods, you know, it seems like it's fundamentally more of a moral judgment than anything else to have this exclusion. And I've spent a lot of time with Senator Farioli recently, in which he has talked about the notion that if you have, you know, if you're treating something as a farm product, you're treating it as a farm product. And this clearly distinguishes marijuana on what seems to be a hard to explain basis.
Yeah. Again, this was not a topic that was widely discussed. I think that those who are in the business of milling grain are probably not also in the business of dealing with edible marijuana. They might sell grain to somebody who does do that. I mean, flour to somebody who does that. But because they're not in the business of marijuana or production containing marijuana, they simply would sell the flour. It wouldn't cover them. It would cover the guy who ultimately used that flour to build a product that contained marijuana. So that's a narrowing, at least from where you may be thinking about it.
So I was just noting, I was observing that point.
And if this became a significant issue, of course, if this is a House bill, it could be dealt with in the Senate if that was an important point that needed clarification.
I have one other question.
Other comments on the Dash 8? Representative Vance Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not being here for the amendment to be discussed, but I had a question, I guess, for Representative Davis, as he is one of the chiefs on the bill, and your opinions about the Dash 8s versus the Dash 5s or some of the preceding amendments, because there are some differences, certainly. We've got the bakery and dairy products removed, and it's just into grains and so forth, so I don't. Maybe you had a chance to share that already, but I'd be interested in hearing your input.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I'm fine with the direction we're going with the A8s.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Woodson.
Yeah, I'm going to be a yes on this too, but I have a question about the grains. If this includes, would include for alcohol, the production of mashes or, I mean, that's a food product. If this would, that would fall under that for these distilleries?
I think that's already covered in line 15 and 16. Okay. Does not include persons engaged in the business of producing alcoholic beverages.
Okay, all right.
And I think that's the reason, frankly, why that was put there last time.
Okay.
Yeah, was not to confuse that with food production. I think many of us enjoy spirits, but few of us think of it as food.
Yeah. It all depends.
You.
On the day.
Any other discussion of the Dash 8? Any objection to the Dash 8? Seeing that it's so ordered, Representative Bentz?
Chair, I move House Bill 3125 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3125 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Representative Leininger.
Thank you. You know, again, I've committed to you that I'm a courtesy yes on this, but I would say it's as someone who's formerly worked for a manufacturing company that buys, equipment that costs $100,000 or more from time to time, I would note that it's just not obvious to me what the logical stopping point is for when we exempt things from taxes. And we spend a lot of time talking about how we don't have the revenue to fund an adequate school year and other key basic service needs, and then we add property tax exemptions that, in my view, don't necessarily have a logical a rationale that distinguishes them from a lot of other business things that could also seek exemptions, and we need to think about that.
Thank you. Further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Representative Johnson?
No, we're in good shape. I think we're both okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
The left wing here is okay.
So you're a yes. All right. I don't see any objection to the motion. The motion carries. And the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll ask Representative Hoyle to carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3125. Colleagues, we're obviously not ready. I've already set over House Bill 2077. We're clearly not ready to work 2968, and so we've completed our business for today. We haven't posted anything yet, but I do expect a meeting on Monday at 1 o'clock, so be prepared for that. And also, because we're toward the end of the session, we could have a meeting at any time on relatively short notice to deal with issues that none of us know about yet. So just simply be. We'll know about them then, obviously, but we simply don't know about them now. And I think most members are anxious to achieve a sine die resolution at an earlier rather than a later date, and that you never know when some action of this committee will promote that act. So be prepared. And thank you very much. And with that, the committee is adjourned.